Well, it's really good to have everybody here with us today. If there are any visitors meeting with us for the very first time, then please fill out a visitor's card that's in a small rack in the pew in front of you. At the end of our service, a few of our members will go around and collect those. We would just love to get in contact with you and thank you for your participation in our worship and ask you if you have any questions at all about the Bible, about God, about our congregation, or anything of a spiritual nature. And we'll sit down and open up our Bibles together and get you an answer. Now, based on the title of today's lesson, you would think that I would bring my well-worn copy of True Grit with me today and quote a few passages from that book. It's one of my favorite books, by the way. Both of the versions of the movie were good, but the book, you know how they always say it? The book really is better. But I was actually presented with a perfect introduction about a week or so ago that's even better than a quote from True Grit. We were all out riding bikes together as a family, and about halfway done with our bike ride, Sterling's foot got caught up in the pedal. He ended up getting kind of a nasty little rash on the back of his ankle. Now, he was sitting there nursing his wounds, and he said, "I really want to go home right now. Can we just go home? It hurts so badly." And I said, "Well, what are you going to do if we go home? Because it'll hurt there, too." He said, "I'll hide it under a pillow." I really like that. But here's what I told him. So we're halfway between home and the playground. Okay? Halfway between home and the playground. We were going to ride our bikes to the playground. Now, either way, that little cut's going to hurt. It could hurt at home. It could hurt at the playground. It's not going to hurt any more or less depending on where you go. It's going to hurt either way. So where would you like that to hurt? And he said, "Well, I guess at the playground." I said, "Good choice." Now, in that 8-year-old version of it, that is, at its core, grit. Grit is the ability to withstand something. Grit is the ability to endure something in the midst of trials, in the midst of pain, in the midst of suffering. Grit is the ability to get up and keep moving toward a destination because you know that the destination is absolutely worth it. Now, grit as a concept of endurance might come from the idea of a pearl found inside of a little creature, an oyster, a clam, whatever. There's different kinds of creatures that will produce a pearl. There's fresh water, there's salt water. But really, the idea of a pearl comes from that piece of grit. And I actually was researching, it's more often than not, it's not grit or sand. It's actually a little parasite that might get inside of the creature. But this little parasite or this piece of sand or this piece of grit doesn't belong in there. And so what it will do is it will produce kind of a mucousy film around that grit, around that sand or that parasite, and put layer after layer after layer after layer after layer of this mucus in order to deal with the parasite or the grit. And now, what comes out of all of that experience, as we witness it, is a pearl. It's kind of weird to think about a pearl, something so beautiful and something so valuable coming out of what is essentially a creature that says, "I've got sand in my eye and I'm trying to deal with it." Or "I've got a mosquito bite and here's how I'm going to deal with it." That's basically what this mollusk is doing with that piece of grit or that parasite. Let's have our Bibles open to Hebrews chapter 10 and read a few verses here. And this is going to be our main text for the day. We'll probably come back and note it a few times. So I'd like to look pretty closely here at Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 32. He says, "But remember the former days, when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. Partly," in verse 33, "by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated." Now, let us thank God every single day that we are able to express ourselves spiritually in prayer, to study His Word, to come together in worship, to proclaim the gospel to all who will listen to it in a relatively unmolested manner. That we're not made a public spectacle, so to speak, the way that they were in the first century just because we're Christians, just because they were Christians. And I thank my God every day that I live in a time and a place where I have that ability and I have that freedom. But he goes on to say in verse 34, "For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one." Now, that's hard to think about, isn't it? The idea of not only being made a public spectacle, of not only sympathizing with others who have been made a public spectacle, but to joyfully accept the seizure of your property just because of your profession of faith. And the way he puts it there, to joyfully accept that. Joyfully accepting the seizure of your property. Something good coming out of something bad. A joyful experience in the midst of suffering and trial. That's grit. Now, he goes on to say in verse 35, "Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance." You have need of endurance. You have need of grit. You have need of endurance so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised, the pearl at the end of the experience. "For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him." If he gives up when the going gets tough, my soul has no pleasure in him. And verse 39, "But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul." Now, I like the word grit. I like the word grit because it's one of those words that it sounds like what it is. Kind of like from the Bible, the word sluggard. Sluggard is what it is. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a lazy person. Grit is the same way. It's got a lot of hard sounds. It's got a hard R and a T at the end of it. It is grit. It sounds like it, and so it is. But it comes by a lot of different names. Maybe you know the word determination. Maybe you know the word resilience. Maybe you call grit fortitude or endurance or perseverance. These are all biblical terms. So even though you can't find the word grit in the Bible, or at least in my translation, New American Standard, there's all these other words that are in the Bible. And we, as Hebrews chapter 10 says, we have need of that. We have need of grit. Why do so few people seem to possess it, though? Why is it such a difficult concept to grasp? Why is it that when we look for somebody with that grit, that true grit, right? Why do we have such a hard time finding somebody to stand up for what's right and to endure in the end? Many people, not just today, but I think for all time, many people lack true grit. They struggle with self-doubt. They struggle with weakness. They struggle with self-pity and the resolve to keep going when the going seems to get tough. But who were the supposed failures of the Bible? Who were some of the people in the Bible who did experience problems and trials and suffering, yet endured it because of their grit? I'll give you one great example here right away. In Acts chapter 14, and everybody loves the Apostle Paul. Paul was one of those guys, rugged, right? That's a word you could come up with for Paul, was rugged. Traveled the world preaching the gospel under difficult circumstances. Who knows? He never knew where he was going to sleep that night. Never knew what was on the horizon. Never knew what was next. He was shipwrecked. He was beaten. He was stoned. And we have an example of that right here in Acts chapter 14, beginning in verse 19. "Now, some came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead." Now, if he survived the stoning, a smart man would have just left and never come back, right? Maybe a smart man would have quit being a Christian, or at least quit proclaiming it so publicly and getting himself into so much trouble. Somebody who was really smart, would never have set foot again in the city of Lystra. They never would have done that again. Smart by what standard, though, right? The world has its idea of, well, if you were smart, you wouldn't be such a loudmouth Christian. If you were smart, you wouldn't proclaim your faith. So if you were smart, you'd just keep quiet and stay in the back of the classroom and not make any comments. If you were smart, if you knew what was best for you. But look at Paul here. They dragged him outside the city. They thought he was just dead, and they left him out there like a dead body. But while the disciples stood around him, I've always liked this verse, while people were standing around him, looking at him, maybe poking him with a stick to see if he was alive still, while the disciples were standing around him, he arose and entered the city? What? That's the last thing that he should have done, right? But he entered the city, and the next day he went away with Barnabas to Derbe. The very next day. You know, the very next day, he's not wasting time recuperating when there's stuff to be done. There's work to be done out there. There's the next town that we need to go to. Kick the dust from your feet and move on. Now, after he had preached the gospel to that city, that is Derbe, and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra. He went back to where he'd been stoned, and to Iconium and to Antioch, the very place where those Jews had come from in verse 19, who'd come to stone him. And strengthening the souls in verse 22, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying, through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. Through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. And those with grit will find it. Go to Matthew chapter 24 and see what Jesus has to say here about those who enter, those who find. He says here in Matthew chapter 24 in verse 13, but the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. The one who has grit. Now somebody might have looked at Paul and thought he was kind of a failure, maybe even a bit of a blundering figure. That wherever Paul went, he made enemies. Wherever Paul went, people would stone him or kick him out of town. He'd have to leave one town out of a basket through a window. He'd have to leave another town because people warned him that there were those trying to kill him. I mean, you could look at Paul and say, boy, he just like, in terms of PR, public relations, in terms of saving his image, Paul was just kind of a blundering figure. He caused messes for himself wherever he went. But the same is true of a lot of people in the Bible, and time simply does not give us the ability in this context, in this venue, to talk about people like Ruth. Oh, Ruth, boy, she had grit. She had a lot of grit. She endured a lot of things. The death of her husband, the death of her father-in-law, following her mother-in-law to a strange land, to a land where, with customs and language and people that she didn't know, to a family that wasn't hers, at least biologically speaking. And when her mother-in-law was feeling sorry for herself at home, saying, just call me Bitter from now on, that's my new name. Ruth is out there working, feeding her family, what was left of it at least. Ruth, oh, what a great character. Joshua, boy, dare to stand like Joshua, right? There's a reason why we sing about Joshua and we study him and we get so much out of his story. That's grit. Moses had grit. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, you had to have grit. At one point, Jeremiah's enemies had taken him. They were tired of listening to him preaching and prophesying all the time, and they threw him into a muddy pit. Now, the text calls it a muddy or miry pit, but it probably was more like a cesspool. It was probably a place that had feces and human waste in it, and they threw him into the bottom of a pit. They were so tired of listening to him preaching and prophesying. You have to have grit to endure that. Hezekiah had to have grit. When the Assyrian emperor and all of his armies are outside the gates of Jerusalem, literally outside the gates, waiting to destroy the city, and Hezekiah didn't flinch. Hezekiah didn't blink. Hezekiah prayed. John the Baptist also. Esther. Noah. Oh, the Bible is filled with such examples of grit and endurance and perseverance. But one might wonder, how do you develop this kind of grit? How can we read Hebrews 11 and all these great heroes of faith like Abraham and Moses and others, and how can we develop that same kind of grit? Well, here's my first piece of advice for developing grit. Start small. Yes, just start small. Remember in that mollusk, that grain of sand or that tiny parasite, it's so small compared to the rest of the creature. It's so small compared to the rest of it. And yet, it is an irritant, and the creature has to do something with it. Start small. Very small, even. My question is, do we get upset by a little obstacle here and there? Do we get so upset by the obstacles that we fail to see that there's like that nugget of wisdom or that nugget of truth in there? Go to Psalm 119, verse 71. And the way the psalmist put it is very telling of his attitude toward suffering. He says in Psalm 119, verse 71, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I may learn thy statutes. That was his attitude. He appreciated affliction. It was good for me to be afflicted because I can learn thy statutes. It was good for me to be afflicted because I can appreciate law, right, wrong. It was good for me to be afflicted because in that affliction, something good came about. Something that I never could have learned without affliction, I learned in the midst of affliction. Sometimes the best we can do to cultivate grit is to just start small. Look for the little lesson in life. Look for the small opportunity, the incremental step toward growth. Now that's really important to do with your kids as well. Our kids need to learn grit. Now that doesn't mean every one of our kids has to be tough and play football or whatever like that. But our kids have to learn the concept of enduring through trial, even little trials. We tried camping with all the kids Friday night. Just a little one-night thing. Went up Friday night and came back Saturday afternoon. Just wanted to try camping. Now, I went camping with Sterling and he did great. But he's an 8-year-old boy. Give him rocks and trees and a creek and he's fine. You know, he'd raise himself. But, you know, our little dainty, sweet girls, we wanted to see, well, how are they going to handle this? Just a little taste of grit. A bed that's a little less comfortable than the one you have at home. Food, you know, freeze-dried food. Just a little bit of grit. And I think it's important to do that with kids. Just start off small, little things that you can do with your kids to just teach them to be a little bit uncomfortable. You don't always have to be comfortable in life. Little things like that. Little things. Now, on a more serious note, getting away from things like camping and that sort of thing, on a more serious note, when you have faced some kind of trial or tragedy, maybe you've lost a loved one recently, maybe you got some bad news from the doctor about your own body, an illness that you're facing, maybe things aren't going well at work and it's becoming a real anxiety or a stressor on you, maybe your marriage is struggling right now and it's weighing heavy on you, maybe you're in high school and you're being bullied right now, and the same bully every single day picks on you in the same way. You're enduring something. You're facing something. The best way that you can develop grit is to just start small. Something right now. Something today. When you've lost a loved one, get up the next morning. Take a shower. And until you've lost someone really close to you, you have no idea how hard it is to wake up the next day and take a shower and face that day without that person. When you're being bullied, until you've been bullied, you have no idea how hard it is to just get up and go back to school. You have no idea how hard it is until you're in those shoes. You have no idea how hard it is when you are struggling at work and it is a constant anxiety because of your broken relationship with a boss or a coworker or gossip in the work, but you have no idea how hard it is just to not hit the snooze button. Get up and go to work. But that's how we develop grit. You pay the next bill. You go back to work. You go to school. And that's a small thing. But grit has to start small. Grit is usually found in the ordinary, not the extraordinary. That's true of your relationship with your kids. That's true of your relationship with a spouse. I've done a lot of marriage counseling over the years. And one of the things that I notice is people always want to know, like, what's the key? What's the key to success? What's the key to building a really good relationship? How do I deal with a relationship that's gone bad? What's the key to all of this? And I always tell people, you are not going to find success in a marriage or any other relationship for that matter with the big gestures. Now, I know there's a place for the big gestures, all right? There's a place for that sort of thing. But you're going to find success in any relationship in the little things, the thing that you're doing day after day after day. I have heard parents say this, and I've said this as well. I would die for my kids. And you know what? I believe them. I truly believe that almost every parent out there, almost every parent would die for his or her kids. But isn't it funny? Maybe not funny, maybe ironic, maybe just sad. People would die for their kids. And again, I really do believe that in the heat of the moment, a mugger pulls a gun, most of us would die for our kids. I truly believe that. Instinct would take over. But it's sad that the same people who say, I would die for my kids, can't say no to their boss when he asks them to stay a few hours extra. No, I gotta get home to my kids. Help my kids with their homework. Family time's important to me. We eat together as a family around the table every night. I'm not sacrificing that for a few extra dollars. Or to get, you know, earn a favor or something from my boss. People who say they would die for their kids, they won't be there for their kids emotionally when they're struggling when a boyfriend or girlfriend breaks up with them. They won't be there when their kids are struggling somehow because somebody at school dies, a tragedy happens, a friend gets killed in a car wreck. They won't be there for them emotionally. You know, you say you'll die for your kids, and I believe you. Love is not about the big gesture. Love is not about jumping in front of a bullet for a loved one. Love is, are you there every single day doing the little things, the ordinary things for your wife, your husband, your children, for people at church? Are you doing the ordinary things for God? It's easy when you're in a foxhole and there's things blowing up all around you to say, God, I give my life to you. I believe in you. Please don't let me die. That's easy to do when there's things blowing up all around you. But grit is found in, I'm going to love and obey and adore God right now when my life is comfortable. That's grit. Grit is daily. It's ordinary, not extraordinary. Failure is also a teacher. It has been rightly said on one of my favorite shows that I mentioned before, on Mythbusters on Discovery Channel. They very correctly point out that failure is always an option. And that's true. Failure is always an option because failure at least gives you a data point to work with. You can learn something from failure. So even though you've failed, you can still grow and learn something from that failure. In fact, I think you're just being naive if you go into any new endeavor thinking that there won't be some failure at some point. Failure is always an option, and failure teaches you something. Resilience isn't found in always sticking to the tasks that are easy. Resilience is found in going and making yourself uncomfortable. It's not found in skills that you've already mastered or avoiding potentially challenging situations. It's found in failure and in the lessons that you learn from failure. Go to Galatians chapter 6. In your New Testament, in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 10, he says here, "Do not be deceived, God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh shall from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit shall from the Spirit reap eternal life. And let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we shall reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." Look again at verse 9. Let us not lose heart in doing good. Now, on occasion, are you going to lose heart, or at least feel the temptation to lose heart when you fail somehow? I can only tell you just my experience personally as a preacher. Nothing feels better than just hitting one out of the ballpark. And nothing feels worse than laying a stinker, right? Just nothing feels worse than making a mistake of some kind, like using the phrase laying a stinker in a sermon, like that. There you go. I'll have to lay that one down. Brian can edit that part out. But nothing feels worse than saying something that has been taken the wrong way, or that was said in the wrong way, or that has affected somebody negatively in a way that you weren't anticipating. And I felt the temptation as a preacher to say, you know what? I can't handle the responsibility anymore. I quit. I'm going to go be a furniture salesman. But he says, let us not lose heart in doing good. Don't lose heart in doing good. You may extend yourself in some way, say, I'm going to get out of my comfort zone, and I'm going to learn a new skill, and I'm going to do something new, and then you fail, or somebody criticizes you, or somebody calls you out for the wrong way for saying it or phrasing it, and the temptation is to go like this, and to go back inside, and to say, hey, I tried getting out of my comfort zone, and it blew up in my face. I tried doing something I wasn't good at, and as it turns out, I wasn't good at it, so I give up. Whatever. He says, do not lose heart in doing good. So you fail sometimes. You try something new and it blows up in your face. Don't lose heart in doing good, for in due time we'll reap if we do not grow weary. in due time. Now, in due time, we'll reap in this life. If you practice something enough, if you apply yourself enough, if you learn from the failure, even if the failure happens again and again and again, if you do not lose heart, you'll reap. You'll reap. Something will come from it. And if not in this life, then certainly in the next life when we're with God in heaven. That's a very powerful thing to keep in mind. In Matthew chapter 24, we need to be in it for the long haul. The one who endures to the end, that's the person who will be saved. Through all the ups and downs, we need to decide in advance that the desired outcome is worth the obstacles. Do hard things. I've always liked that phrase. Do hard things. Make yourself uncomfortable. When an opportunity comes to do something hard, right? Hard, do it. Do something hard. Do something difficult. If you've run a half marathon, try a full marathon. And if you try a full marathon and you're not dead, there's always an ultra marathon, I suppose. There's crazy people who run 100 miles. But let's say you haven't done anything. And your doctor's told you over and over again that you've got to lose some weight, cholesterol's high, blood pressure's not good. Now, can you do something? Take that first walk, take that first step, eat a little bit less. I mean, doing hard things may be very hard for you. Something may be really easy for somebody else. What's hard for you is going to be different for everybody. But do hard things. Push yourself. Challenge yourself in some way. Now, I've always liked the way it's described here in Hebrews 5, speaking of Jesus learning something. And yeah, this is it's kind of an odd verse. Kind of an odd idea to think about Jesus learning something. But it says in Hebrews chapter 5, beginning in verse 7, beginning in verse 7, in the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. And in verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal life. Think about that. The omniscient, the all-knowing God. He comes in the form of Jesus of Nazareth, God as man. And he had to learn something. God learned something. He learned obedience from suffering. Something he could not have learned unless he had become a human being. To endure all things as we endure them. He learned obedience through his suffering. Now that's the example that we have in Jesus. He did something hard. You think it was easy for Jesus to leave the right hand of the Father? You think it was easy for him to take deity and stuff it into bodily form the way Colossians describes it, deity dwelling in bodily form? You think it was easy for a God who is used to being everywhere at all places at once to have to walk everywhere he went? Was it easy for him to endure a faithless generation asking for signs all the time? Isn't it interesting that the omnipotent God who created the entire universe with nothing but words struggled to carry a wooden beam up a hill? He did hard things, willingly, knowingly, so that he could learn obedience through his suffering. Now that's the example that we have. And here's the way Peter puts it in 1 Peter chapter 2. You have been called for this very purpose, he says in verse 21, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps. He left you an example. He suffered. We also must learn to suffer. And he learned things through his obedience. And James chapter 1 speaks to that as well, that when we learn to endure in the midst of our sufferings, what's the result? He says that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now here's the last point I want to make before the lesson is over. Take your lumps. When you're wrong, you're wrong. Take your lumps. Learn how to be offended. Learn how to accept criticism. Learn how to let arguments die before they have a chance to start. Grit is often not found in what you say, but in what you choose not to say. Grit is the quality of practicing self-control and self-discipline with your words. As James 1, verses 19 through 21 puts it so perfectly, encapsulating this idea the way only God can. This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Our angry outbursts, our petty acts of self-defense and self-righteous excuse-making. And anytime somebody criticizes you, if you're always going like this, yeah, well, but... James chapter 1. And if you're scrolling through Facebook and you see someone that's just dead wrong about something, and he needs someone to tell him the right thing, and I'm going to... And if you always have to feel like you have to have an answer for everyone who's wrong about something out there, If you're the master of all grammar and the master of all historical facts, and you know politics better than everybody else out there, and you're going to tell the world, well, we've got to be slow to speak, slow to anger, but quick to hear, quick to listen. We need to learn that hours-long arguments on social media don't produce anything but frustration. We need to stop making excuses for our mistakes when we have made them and simply say, "You're right. I'll try better next time." We need to stop casting our pearls before swine and let willfully ignorant people be ignorant. Because there's other people out there who would love to learn about the gospel, and we are neglecting them and ignoring them because we get so caught up in silly arguments, arguing about genealogies and arguing about words, as the Bible puts it. Luke chapter 10 talks about a certain lawyer. I want to read this one. I like the way the text puts it here. Go to Luke chapter 10 and verse 25. The way the lawyer kind of jostles and positions himself to me is humorous. There's a certain lawyer who stood up in verse 25 of Luke 10. And he put Jesus to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" This is probably one of his go-to gotcha questions that he would ask people. "Well, what is written in the law?" Jesus responds. "How does it read to you?" And so he rattles off a bunch of the Ten Commandments in verse 27 and in verse 28. And he said here, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." Now, wishing to justify himself in verse 29, look at that. Wishing to justify himself, instead of just saying, "You know what, you're right. I should just take the book of Deuteronomy and live it. You're right. I should just love God with all my heart and all my soul, all my strength. I should just be keeping the Ten Commandments. You're right. I should be expressing my religion in acts of unselfishness and love and service. You are right. And I should also stop questioning the Son of God. And I should stop trying to gotcha people with smart questions. You're right." But wishing to justify himself, got to watch out for that. The man didn't have any grit. So instead of outsmarting Jesus, he's the one who got outsmarted. King Saul offers his excuses in 1 Samuel chapter 13, and when Samuel catches him on it, catches him offering sacrifices that he was not lawfully allowed to make, Saul should have said, "You're right. You're right. I was wrong about that. What do I need to do better next time?" Instead, he says, "Yeah, but the Philistines were coming, and all the people of Israel, they were running away. And you were late, Samuel. You said you'd be here 7 days. You were late. There's no grit there. And instead, King Saul just looks kind of babyish and pathetic, doesn't he? How about Genesis chapter 3? The fall, Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, they eat the fruit, and God says, "Where are you guys?" And they're hiding in the bushes naked. They say, "Well, we're naked and we're ashamed and we're hiding from you." "Well, who told you that?" Adam says, "She did it." And Eve looks around for a slithering serpent. She says, "Where did he go? He did it." And they end up looking pretty pathetic, because they don't take responsibility for when they've done something wrong. They don't just say, "I'm sorry." Ecclesiastes 10, verse 4. "The anger of the king will be allayed if you just stay at your post." It's better to just stay at your post, take responsibility for your mistakes, than to try and hide or run or make excuses. And of course, compare the excuse makers and the self-defenders and the social media justice warriors and the bloggers and the people who argue on the news. Compare all the excuse makers of the world to Jesus, who, when he was faced with false accusations, said nothing. And like a lamb that is silent before its shearers, like a little sheep that is led away to slaughter, he said nothing. He said nothing. Because he knew what he was doing was the right thing. That's grit. We've got to learn grit, my friends. We've got to learn endurance and perseverance. And it starts now. It starts today. Will you be a better Christian, a better parent, a better spouse, a better worker, a better citizen? Will you be a better child of God and devote your life more wholly and more completely to him? If you have any spiritual needs at all, please let them be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.